Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Charles Yu, author of Interior Chinatown, this year's National Book Award Prize. The paperback was published in November by Pantheon. Why the prize is in bronze, I don't know, instead of gold. Charles wrote How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, which was great. And we talked about that back in 2010 when he had little kids who are now 13 and 10. So, and Sorry, Please, Thank You, his short story collection we discussed back in 2012. His writing has also appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Wired, among many other publications. And he also writes a lot for television now, including Westworld. Interior Chinatown is about generic Asian man who longs to be Kung Fu guy. Although the book is not science fiction, we do find ourselves living in a world that is not quite real, yet is. Willis Wu, not Charles Yu, sometimes is his protagonist, wavers between his lofty goals, given his current status, and a kind of self-pity, which, as I say it, seems a little unfair. He appears on TV in episodes of Black and White, starring a black and white couple, almost couple. The book is framed by epigraphs from The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life by Irving Goffman, as well as a summary of the United States' horrible laws regarding the absence of status and citizenship for Chinese Americans over the, actually, centuries. So we learn what it's like to be trapped, to be looked at as the other, and to cope with the question of whether you are the most put upon, or is your attitude, whether you're Asian or not, framed by the manner in which you present yourself. Hi, Charles. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, Sam.
You may very well know this, but do you know what a first edition of Goffman's book is worth now?
I do not. I imagine it's a lot.
$2,000.
Okay. Wow. I can't afford that.
Yeah, and it was nice of you not to know. So why are you going to keep rereading this book, as you say in the acknowledgments, until, and this is kind of an absolute, until you can't read anymore?
Well, you know, I picked up that book at least 15 years ago at a bookstore, a student store at UCLA. And it was one of those, you know, random things that I didn't know what, I'd never heard of it. And I wasn't particularly looking for anything. And it's one of the reasons I really miss bookstores, especially independent bookstores, because you have the chance for something like that happening. And, you know, very few books have stuck with me like Goffman's has. It's a really powerful framework, you know, for me to understand, you know, daily interactions between friends, family, strangers, and just sort of, it's given me vocabulary and insight into, you know, how we are, even in just going through our lives, often performing, or we're an audience, or we're both at the same time. And that was really kind of the foundation for a lot of this book.
You know, I guess we may have talked about this before, but in my bookstore, I feel the same way. And I think I told you the story about how people will go up the book, the library ladder, and they'll see the book they want. And then, like you, they also see the books that are around it. And it's one of those books that may change your life like Goffman's did. And it's one of the luxuries of being in an independent bookstore.
Yeah, I think the books around it is a good way to think about it. It's the accidents, you know, the kind of, you know, whether it's serendipitous or it's someone like you, you know, a bookseller actually putting that book there, you know, either way, it's just hard to replace that. So
that's how I found Don DeLillo and Ratner Star. I never would have found him otherwise. I never would have known who the heck he was. And now, of course, I've read all this stuff. I also, you may have heard of this movie called The Motel. It's I looked up the 20 best Asian American films, and it was one of them. And I was gonna, if you have seen it, great. But if you haven't, I think it's a good movie for you to watch.
Check it out.
Yeah. Hey, did you know there were at least Charles two Charles Yu attorneys in San Francisco besides you?
I knew about one because I have gotten calls about someone. Maybe it wasn't the one in San Francisco, but I've gotten calls about like my credit card, which is scary if you think about it, because you would hope that there isn't confusion that way. But yeah,
I feel kind of bad about them because now people are going to think they won the National Book Award. I have to explain to them how they didn't meet some other guy.
Maybe we'll all meet someday. We can have a Charles Yu party.
Oh, that's a great book. Three Charles Yu attorneys in San Francisco. They get confused. They have the same clients, but they have to treat their cases differently. So anyway, now, you know, now that you're this big shot on TV as well, did that influence you in writing the book as a kind of screenplay in part? Did you think about it that way?
I didn't initially. For whatever reason, the idea did not occur to me until I'd been trying to write this book for a few years. But it was really the voice of Willis that came first. The opening lines of the book are actually some of the first that I wrote. And it doesn't always happen that way for me. But in this case, it was like, oh, here's a guy, generic Asian man, and dreams of being a kung fu guy. And right there, I felt I have a character and I have a place that the character wants to go. And pretty quickly after that, the question was, is this a show? You know, and if this is a show, do I write this as a screenplay? And I was worried about it. You know, I will say it's not conventional, and some readers may open the book and say, I don't know what this is. This isn't for me. So I worried about it, but not for that long, because really it was the form telling me, you know, the form and the substance just were talking to each other. And that's often what I'm looking for, because then I get really excited to try it.
Yeah, now it's going to be, or probably already has been, optioned by Netflix for.
It's Hulu. It's actually Hulu. So,
you know, it's really cool because it's very cinematic, and it could be a series, and it could be a standalone. And then you'd have to do the fade in, fade out where, well, I'm not going to give any spoilers away. Kind of like, well, where his life is two different things. Anyway, it's funny. We talked a little bit before about you growing up and whether you were aware of being perhaps generic and perhaps not. And what that reminded me of is back in 2001, 2003, my ex-wife and I adopted two girls from China, one from Xi'an, where the terracotta soldiers are, and one from Shaanxi. And I never, not once thought of them as being Chinese, because they were just my daughters. And then I don't understand when other people think they're Chinese. It makes no sense. But then when I go out with my friend Martin, who's Chinese, and we're sitting out for dinner, everyone comes up to him and they go, oh, you have two lovely daughters. I'm like, what? They're my daughters.
Right.
But anyway, so I thought about, then I was thinking about, okay, so where are all these generic Asian guys and women? And I thought, okay, Chinese restaurants, obviously. And the weird thing is sushi restaurants as well, where they're not Japanese anymore. They're generally Korean. And no generic white guys like me. So one of the things that you talk about, and I don't know, well, it's like taxi drivers in New York being Muslim and taxi drivers in San Francisco being Ukrainian or something. It's funny how people fit into these things. So you chose a Chinese restaurant, but you also talk about accents and how sometimes you're required to get along to pose with an accent that you don't actually have. Is that really true?
Well, it hasn't, you know, literally been true for me as a lawyer/writer, but I think it is true for actors. You know, I think the role has been historically, and probably still is, you know, I mean, I've certainly seen it in recent years where you see a character who is of Asian descent and, you know, could have an accent, but also doesn't need to have an accent. I mean, it's one thing if the story is saying this person is from, you know, a different country and they're a very recent immigrant, they probably have an accent. But it's another thing to give a character an accent when there's no reason for that character to have an accent. Either they were born here or they've been here a very long time. And so it's a signifier, I think, right? It's telling, I think it's intended to say this is an other, you know, or it's done, I think, even maybe more, somewhat more difficult to get at, is when it's done unconsciously, when they think, well, this character has an accent and it's written that way because there's a kind of assumption that this is an outsider. And that gets at, and so in the book, I think, Willis has to navigate that, right? He's expected to perform with an accent. And I think that's something that, between the accent and wardrobe and basically behavior, Willis is constrained. He's expected to perform as Asian man, right? You know, that's what he's supposed to be. And that's, obviously very reductive. And, that mindset, you know, both externally imposed on Willis, but also that he has internalized. That's what I was interested in exploring, sort of both of those, what both of those pressures would do to somebody.
And it's funny how you move up from number three, number two, number one to possibly being episodic. And then also how he watches, as his dream progresses, he watches Kung Fu that stars Kane, which is David Carradine, who isn't Asian at all.
Right.
And but what you talk about, what Willis talks about, is the cadence of his speech and what he says is what gives him his specific, almost Asian view of the world. That was interesting.
Yeah. I was interested in both exploring, you know, what it is in sort of American TV and movies that's supposed to say, here, look, here's a Asian thing, you know, and like a gong sound, right? Or a certain kind of diction, even accent or not, there's a certain kind of diction. It's awkward, often, you know, sort of bad grammar. And how much, you know, actually that forms some of the basis of my understanding, you know, like, because I grew up here and I grew up watching that stuff. So,
Yeah. And you grew up where a lot of this actually happened too.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. This is going to take a while, but bear with me because it's all about you. Okay. Here's the things. The reason I'm saying it, because I've never seen this before. Here are the things that people have said about your book and what it is. Okay. It's going to take a while. Go ahead and drink. It says, you are sprightly, playful, heartfelt, ascend up, funniest, delicious, incisive, melancholic, whimsical, literary, weird, experimental, sharp, dark, evocative, inventive, wrenching, hilarious, surreal, original, brilliant, unexpected, upending, clever, deep, fascinating, masterful, heartbreaking, conflating, inspired, daring, cerebral, absurdist, workmanlike, emotive, story-bending, lovely, manic, nimble, laugh out loud, strange, grade A-, what the fuck, A-, outstanding, enchanting, untraditional, glorious, entertaining, impressive, eclectic, nonlinear, Beckettian, Vonnegutian, Saunders-ian, Dickian, pardon me, and Bradburyian. So when I interviewed you 10 years ago, I didn't think you were all that. And I still don't think you're all that. So what's the deal?
Yeah, I wrote that about myself. So you're just reading Goodreads under, I don't know, lawyer author 25 or whatever my burner account is on Goodreads. I don't know where. Deeply uncomfortable listening to that list of adjectives, but
I mean, it's a great book, but there's nobody that's all those things.
Definitely not. Definitely not me.
Many of them I should have put in parentheses two or three because they've been used by other critics. So, but that was something that struck me when I was researching and plus the National Book Award. So when we started out, how to live safely in a science fictional universe, yeah, I thought you were on your way, and we were joking about whether all your protagonists would be named Charles Yu and everyone would get confused and all that stuff. Obviously, kind of a cliche question, but did you ever think in your wildest dreams that this would be what would happen to you?
Definitely not. Up to and including the moment when, Roxane Gay said Interior Chinatown, and during the ceremony, I literally did not believe that was happening. I freaked out, as I have been lamenting ever since the moment it happened. I forgot to thank my family. That's sort of how out of my mind I was. And yeah. It's awful. Trust me, that's the worst feeling. It feels like this is not, it just doesn't seem right. It just seems like someone's going to come take it away, but and that would be okay. I'm really happy that the book is out there and that it's done and that people get to read it and that I wrote something that was the expression, in large part, what I was aiming for, in all of its kind of idiosyncrasies and strange, visual and storytelling devices, that at its core, there's an emotional story about a family and about a guy who is, trying to transcend the role he's been given. And when it was for many years, really close to 7 years, between 6 and 7 years I spent writing this book, I just thought, this is really hard, probably harder than it should be. I'm making it too hard. Nobody's going to know what it is, and nobody's going to like this. And yet I couldn't stop writing it. So,
yeah, it's funny. If I was reviewing it, I would just say it's weird.
Just short, two words.
Weird book. Your other two books are weird, too. So anyway, I wanted to talk about the cover, which, do you have one? Because you can barely see it there. Do you have one in front of you?
Yeah, I have the paperback. I might have a hard cover somewhere here too.
Oh yeah, it's funny how they always change them.
Yeah, there's the paperback. Can you see it?
And
then here's the hardcover.
The hardcover. The hardcover is cool because, in addition to having that kind of, almost like a Chinese menu to me kind of look, and it has the movie projector and the kung fu foot. Yeah. And kind of a marquee kind of look too. So did you vet it? Did you have anything to do with it? Oh yeah, and the credits, your credits, which won like a movie credit. It talks about the cover and who did it. Now I've forgotten. But anyway,
Tyler Comrie, I think, was the book designer, which is really cool. He did a great job.
Yeah. So did you like look at a bunch of them, or did you just pick that one out, or what?
No, I did do the acknowledgments as movie credits. I was proud of myself for that one. Tyler Comrie designed the cover and Anna Knighton designed the text. There's a whole bunch of other people that are involved with making the book. But the first time I saw it, it was like this. And I thought, wow, from the choice of the color, like you said, it's sort of evokes menus to the paper they actually use. You can't tell here, but it's got this kind of distressed, aged quality to it. Even the fact that the gates here to Chinatown are kind of prison bars, I just thought it was brilliant. I think they did an amazing job.
If they knew you were going to win the National Book Award, they could have laminated it like a Chinese menu,
Right. Yeah, I love the paperback too. I mean, it's inspired by, but also feels like different. It feels slightly friendlier. I don't know if that's intentional.
It's more accessible. It's really interesting how they do that. The reason why publishers do them is because they know how to sell books. I mean, I've told you this before, but in my bookstore and your book's on the front table, it's like everyone has told you all your life you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover, unless they know what they want when they come in. Yeah. And it's so funny because it's like, this is why they buy the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. It's this weird, amazing art, art to it of like synthesizing, you know, a whole book.
That's why it's good.
Yeah. And creating a kind of separate, not statement, but like something evocative that says, you know, here's the promise of what might be inside of here.
It's like, well, both of us are attorneys, and I remember when ads, by the time you started, ads were all over the place, but they just started out. And I was so upset because I thought, who would go to an attorney because they saw a billboard of a guy saying he was an attorney? It made no sense to me.
Right.
The people who went to them were being deluded because they went to them. They didn't have the common sense to ask their friend or anyway, that bothered me. Moving on, I end up doing this. So if we go through the characters, I wanted to talk a little bit about Willis's father, who was this god in some ways and then was a tragedy in some ways. And again, I'm talking about myself. But the John Denver thing where he sings Country Roads, it's really funny because when I've been in Jamaica, the band there sings Country Roads. And when I was in Fiji, I was so drunk, I got up on the stage to sing it, well, that's another story. But anyway, yeah, so I've noticed that other cultures seem to co-op John Denver's, that song. It's interesting, isn't it?
It is. It's a classic for a reason. I think it hits all kinds of, you know, plucks all kinds of strings inside. But it's, you know, it is about home and belonging and missing home. And there's a scene in the book here where, without spoiling too much, there's some karaoke going on, and a small, you know, sort of bit is about how older Taiwanese men love country roads. And it is, I have found it to be true empirically. This is based on something I've experienced in my own life.
Yeah, and that's what hit home for me too, because I have as well. And then there was a pivotal point in the book, which isn't a spoiler. Well, maybe it is kind of, I'm saying it anyway. So there's a line, when you die, it sucks. And that, I thought, okay, oh, this is going to turn into a Charles Yu book.
You're waiting for that moment. Now I get Stan back there. Stan, right? Is that Stan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Stan can tell you how much it sucks to die, or maybe not. I don't know. He looks like he's doing all right, but
he does as good as he can. We all do.
Yeah. He's keeping in shape at least. I mean, he looks pretty built.
It's his COVID look. I see. That's bad.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about how to talk about that moment. It was another one of those things where, I didn't know what I was doing for a long time, and my editor was really pushing me to figure out what I was doing. And it was actually in the process of trying to explain to him and to my agent what this book was about that I realized, oh, this is my explanation itself should be part of the book. So I actually kind of took that.
Yeah, it's like... this is just the name, so it's not a spoiler. But it's like Phoebe. She can't do what she does, but she does. And it seems totally natural. And it drifts towards you. It's hard to explain. It drifts towards you, but it isn't you. And of course, I'm saying you again, which is recursive. So going back to the characters, everyone's kind of good. There's no one that's really bad or evil in general. Is there? There isn't.
No, I think that's right. Yeah. There is no real antagonist in the book. There's an invisible one, I think, which is the system. The structure of the show itself is keeping everyone locked into their roles. Asians, the background Asians, Karen, black, white, you know, who have names, but they literally get turned into black and white for the purpose of the show. yeah, everyone is trapped within this kind of matrix of their prescripted roles, I guess.
Yeah, and in one of the pivotal scenes, older brother, cool guy, really cool guy, the judge, the attorneys, they're not bad. They're just kind of like pushing. They're pushing towards this final idea of what's going on in my head. And yeah, it was interesting the way you propelled that. I thought it was really well done because it was kind of like, you know, there's like a funnel and it all starts out wide and then all of a sudden here it is. And it's kind of like Goffman in a way, you know, it's okay. Here's the way everyone presents themselves and here's why they are perceived the way they are because of the way they present themselves. And it's not necessarily because you're a judge or you're Miles Turner. Miles Turner is drawn a certain way, like in Roger Rabbit.
Right.
And he has to. I'm not really mean. I'm just drawn this way. And Sarah has to keep reminding him of that. And yeah, see, that's all Goffman influenced, isn't it?
It really is, right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought up. Miles Turner is the black of black and white, and Sarah Green is the white of black and white. And they are, like as you point out, like in Roger Rabbit, they're drawn as the leads, as heroes, you know. Extremely attractive, hyper competent at what they do, tough, you know, like it just a bunch of sort of like, you know, very movie poster sort of attributes, right? They're supposed to be dashing. And then beyond that, they are still people, but inside of their roles, they're only ever seen as their kind of heroic shell. So even though, you know, no one's going to feel sorry for them because they're the leads, they are as much trapped as Willis is or old Asian man or old Asian woman. I mean, so, you know, the idea with writing this as a screenplay is we could, at the same time, we can quickly visually process, here's the official narrative because it's a script. We start to jump back and forth in and out of that official narrative. And it's what I think, I'm probably not getting it exactly right, but it's what, you know, in Goffman would be like front stage and backstage. It's what you present to the audience and then what you keep for yourselves, for your in-group, basically.
Yeah, and if it ever is turned into a series, which it will be, it's like with Miles Turner, that would be as close as you could come to breaking the fourth wall, kind of like Ferris Bueller. When he comes out at the end, he goes, what are you still doing here? Yeah, it's over. Because Miles goes, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I said, I didn't mean it that way, you know?
Right.
It's almost like he would turn to the camera and go, yeah, sorry, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love the Ferris, the comparison. I showed that movie to the kids recently because they're now old enough to be watching some of the, you know, some of the 80s classics.
Yeah, it's great. Well, don't show them, which was the one that had long duck.
Yeah, 16 Candle. I'm glad you brought it up. It's like they'll encounter things like that. I won't be the one that shows them that, but, you know, it won't be long before they watch it or watch something like it and then just think, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, how am I supposed to feel about this? It's a big part of why I wanted to write it. There, you know, my parents were immigrants from Taiwan. I was already growing up very conscious of how they felt, like, you know, they were trying to assimilate into this country. They're foreigners. And so I was in the same household. But my kids are growing up in a household where both of their parents were born here, you know. And so it's a lot different because we're not assimilating. We're Americans, you know, unhyphenated Americans in a lot of ways, culturally, mentally, but they still look the way they look. And so I think externally, they're going to encounter times where they're going to be perceived as Asian, even though they're literally third generation, you know, Americans at this point. And that was also interesting to me, you know, to navigate both the first generation that comes, the kind of middle generation in Willis, and then the generation after of like, what do I do when my inside is one thing and my outside is another thing? And people don't always understand that.
And it's funny because it's like, you know, a school board taking Huckleberry Finn off of the shelves in the curriculum because of particular words that it uses. And now with cancel culture, and this is a good example of it, there's no way that movie could be made. There is no way that they could portray. So that, I guess that's progress, right? But then should it show the movie so that they can see the way things were? Still kind of are, but should they see it that way? Should it be banned?
Right. Yeah. It's such a good question. I think in our household anyway, we don't shy away from the hard conversation. We just figure out what's the right time and mode. You know, is this something we all talk about as a family or even just show them? Or do we just say, here's the thing that you may run across someday, or even let them just run across it and then we talk about it. But it is a good question. I think ultimately it's better to have been exposed, you know, for them than to just encounter it and not have any sort of preparation for what they're going to, you know, come across, because they really don't, you know, on a day-to-day basis, they don't encounter much overt discrimination, you know, if any, really. So living where we live in Southern California, it's very infrequent for them to really encounter like actual sort of someone being racist to their face. That said, they're still conscious of their difference. You know, they're still conscious of not being, I guess, not being white, you know, in America. So, and it's just interesting where that comes from. I think it comes in large part from TV and film, right? I mean, that's mostly what they see on screen as the default. Who's the protagonist? Who's the hero? Who's considered beautiful or handsome? Those default roles still very much, you know, to them are white. So that's where I think that consciousness comes from.
My daughter Annie, who's a lot like me, goes, you know, I'm not going to get into good schools because I'm Asian. Because there's too many Asian kids in the school. So she's really worried about it. And then I never worried about any of this stuff either until Trump called it the China flu. And then actually Annie did say someone at high school did say something like, you caused it. And that's how it starts. And it was really, well, once again, since I don't think they're Chinese, I couldn't figure out, well, why would they tell you? And yeah, that was the first time and only time I've actually seen it.
I'm sorry that I can't imagine that. Yeah, sucked for her. And that's part of what's so dangerous about, you know, him doing that is it's just like, it's both very intentional on his part, Trump's part, but it's also like reckless, right? It's this kind of some kind of gas, you know, like a poison gas bomb that he throws out there that just sort of like, you know, spreads xenophobia through its osmosis or something.
That's all he does. I was thinking about Lucifer and how he was God's right-hand man, and then he made him into a perfect being. And then Lucifer was thinking, well, if I'm perfect, I might as well be God. And then one third of the angels go to hell with him. But I was thinking, okay, there's a kind of grandeur in this. There's no grandeur in Trump. He was always down there just being a steeping pile of crap. So he never fell. He was just always in the muck. And there's no grandeur in that. But there is a grandeur in falling, you know? Wow.
So a poor man's Lucifer.
Yeah.
That seems about right.
And Annie's funny because she's barely 5 feet tall. She's just tiny. And the first day of school, there was this big kid blocking the door that she had to get through. He's like that, blocking it. And she walked up to him and she goes, get out of the way. And he did. She just has that. She has. So funny to watch.
Sounds like you did something right.
Yeah, but she denies it because she says, we're not blood. Oh. She's mean.
Yeah.
It's funny. So we talked about Sarah. Oh, yeah. So I always forget that we're actually trying to sell your book, and then I just my life.
It doesn't. This is fun. I like it this way.
So Karen, he's as amazed as I am that she falls for him. And it was interesting that you did that because it so seldom actually happens, but it happens in your book. And she's such a nice person.
She is. So there's this character who, she's basically a lead character, although she's, I guess, maybe a half step under them, under Turner and Green. And she is described as ethnically ambiguous. She's, you know, kind of an amalgam, maybe not even an amalgam. She's a concept that I feel is probably somewhat in the past, but definitely there was a time where it felt like there's one slot for a lead who isn't white or black, but we don't necessarily want to make it clear what they are. We sort of want the flexibility for this person to play as just generally ethnic. And so Karen is that. And she's a big part of the story, and it's through sort of her interest in Willis that he actually starts to kind of become a bigger part of the story himself. Yeah, and he's amazed. He can't believe that she's several leagues out of his league, but yeah, it happens. I mean, I married way up too, you know.
Me too. And then the other thing, you know how you're writing, but you know, like whether this is in a book club book or not, you know, people are going to say, why did he do that? Why was he like that? They're all going to differ. And that's a great book because everyone shouldn't feel the same about it. But when he does what he does with regard to his relationship to Karen, I'm going, you idiot. You're so, how can you do this? Don't you know what you're doing here? But then you explain why he's doing it, and even though it's still kind of stupid, it's just, until the end, it's what he wants to do. It's what he wants to do. And he can't help it, even though this is the best thing he could ever possibly have.
Yeah, there's, I struggled for a long time to figure out what felt right. And I love stories. I both love and hate stories where you're like, you idiot. Yeah, basically, like, come on, you know. But at the same time, if it feels earned and it feels like, well, he's got to go through this to get to wherever he's going, then that's ultimately what the story wants to be. So without spoiling it, I think I know what you mean by you idiot. Yeah, Willis is frequently an idiot in this book. I will say that.
The thing about it is, though, no one, you know, it's like my father said, do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got great advice when I was a kid. I didn't listen to any of it. And I remember one guy who had this horrible marriage. His wife was insane. And when he was walking down the aisle to get married, his best friend reached out and grabbed his sleeve and said, don't do this. Which, wow. I admired, but he just kept going. And if he had just listened to that advice, his whole life would have been changed. But yeah, that's the way people are. The other thing I thought about was, in fact, I thought about it like a half an hour ago, because I went outside and this guy was out there delivering something and he was saying, oh, I love your property because we have peacocks and goats and alpaca and chickens. It's really nice. And I mean, I don't take it for granted because it's been here since 1775. I feel like I'm just taking care of it. But the thing is, he was out there and he was being so nice. He had never said a word to me. I'd never seen him before. And he was just such a nice guy. And then I realized pretty much everybody is nice. You know, it's just that politics and nations are bad. But pretty much everywhere I've gone, the times I've been to China, the times I've been to other countries, everyone is really nice to me. And I don't know why that has anything to do with your book.
Well, I'm connecting it, I think, to the idea that you hit on earlier, which is that there are actually no bad guys in this book or bad characters. There's a system that's making people, you know, forcing people into roles that they don't fit into. And bad things happen because of that. But that's the connective tissue, I think, that I'm drawing there.
Yeah, it's kind of, although in Ayn Rand, it was really bad when she would step out and Nathaniel Brandon would go on with his essays and all that. But you take us out of the book every once in a while and you quote a law or a statute and that you're going, wait a minute. But then that really does shit. That and Goffman's outlook, but those, because you don't think about it. You don't think this is what we did, like in turning the Japanese during World War II. You don't think of that. And then when you're reading that, you go, well, that's impossible. We didn't do that. Mm. And especially for an attorney, that was very well thought out. And that must have been something that came to you. Well, did it come to you before or during the process? When did you decide to do that?
It was during, you know, it grew, I think, naturally out of where the story was going. It just felt like, you know, with older brother going off to law school, what would he learn there, you know? And it felt like a kind of natural way of bringing two of the bigger threads sort of together, Willis's story and this kind of historical and legal background, you know, this process by which marginalized or people have fought for legal rights through the court system and secured those rights slowly and painfully over, you know, centuries. And those rights were kind of a foothold for them to gain status where they had no political or cultural rights or political or cultural power. You know, in some ways the legal system was where the first place where some of these, you know, groups were able to gain any kind of power. So yeah, it felt like the right thing. Plus, you know, a Law and Order episode is structured as like police first half, courtroom second half. So I sort of had to do it.
Yeah, it's funny. After every night we watch Jeopardy, then Wheel of Fortune. And it's so weird now because Alex Trebek is dead, but he's still there and he looks good. And it's like, it's so strange to watch him. It goes back to the kind of stuff you and I think about. But yeah, after we watch that, whenever I, so then I say, what are we going to watch now? And no matter where I scroll, when I scroll, there's always Law and Order and there's always CSI something, always. I've never used my remote control when one of those is not on, ever, not once. And I don't know how they do it. How many episodes are there of each?
It's amazing. I think it's the last thing that will survive. Of Earth.
That and cockroaches.
Yeah. Well, plus it's being beamed out into space, presumably, right? Somewhere there's a signal carrying Law and Order that's like leaving the solar system right now.
Oh, speaking of which, I thought about this too. I said, okay, this is a science fiction guy. And now you're saying how this book was rolling around in your head for a long time, but it still does have that something. So do you think... is this like a, I don't mean to say it this way, but is it like a one-off? Do you think you'll go back to science fiction? Do you think you'll go back to that? Because it seems something that you love so much.
Yeah, I would, you know, I'm sure I'll write stories again that could be classified that way. I also, not that I don't like the label science fiction writer, but I've also never... you know, I don't think of, you know, I don't have like a shirt that says science fiction guy, you know what I mean? Like I just sit down and write the stuff that comes out. And even in the process, I'm not thinking what genre is this? I've, you know, it's just not that conscious. So I think I'll always probably be interested in things that play with genre and form on some level. And so that will probably take me back into the realm of something that you would say, oh, I'll shelve this in science fiction. But that's not really up to me. That's like a subconscious level kind of thing.
Yeah, one of the adjectives I use that they talk about, they do say genre bending. That's another one they use. So I don't know what genre this is. You don't know what genre this is.
No, I do not. I can't even try.
What would you call it? I don't know.
I mean, I guess you could call it yeah, wow, I can't. I'd call it a novel, I think. I don't even know if I'd call it a novel.
It's a
book.
Yeah, okay.
It's a story. We can call it that.
All right. Well, we've pretty much gone through my life. I don't know what to, I got lots of more stories. This is our third time, I guess, in a few years. Hopefully shorter. We can talk again. And I do love talking to you because, like you know, you're like me. You wonder who you are. You wonder where you are. And you wonder what this is. And I think as long as you do that, even though it seems paradoxical, but I think as long as you do that, you're going to be pretty good. I mean, things are going to be okay. But I don't know why I think that. Why do I think that?
I don't know why you think that, but I think I know what you mean by that. I suppose that means you're still in it. You're still, you know, you haven't given up.
Yeah, and I think it also means you're still like not even a kid. You're like a baby. Because you're still, you know, wondering, you know, what did I just fall into? And yeah, that's why you got to keep writing science fiction. Anyway, okay, well, it was great talking to you again. I'm really glad I got the chance to do it. And I'm so happy for you for all the things that have happened in the past few years.
Thank you, Sam. It was really great talking to you again. I hope it's not another 8 years until we talk again.
Yeah, I don't want to get it to be the paperback. I want the hardback.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk soon.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, see ya.